This is The Difference, a podcast for nonprofit fundraising in a for-profit world, presented by Convergent Nonprofit Solutions, a leader in nonprofit fundraising. Convergent's professionals can help your nonprofit secure sustainable funding now and for the future.
I'm glad you could join us today. I'm Jay Wirth with Convergent Nonprofit Solutions. My guest today is Tim Kachuriak. He's the founder and chief innovation and optimization officer for Next After, a fundraising research lab consultancy and training institute. It works with nonprofits, NGOs to help them grow their resource capacity. He's written a couple of books, one of them, Optimize Your Fundraising. And that's what Convergent tries to do for its clients, is help them optimize their fundraising campaigns. So I'm looking forward to talking to Tim, because the question that he's been thinking about and obsessing over for more than a decade is, what makes people give? What's the motivation? Or maybe it's the why. And that question, actually questions the what and the why, have led Convergent to develop its, what we call, the investment-driven fundraising model. And that was some years ago developed by my colleague, Tom Ralzer. So I'm interested in hearing Tim's thoughts about that question. And welcome, Tim.
Jay, thanks for having me today.
Tell me a little bit about Next After. Just give us a brief overview of the firm and your goals are with the firm.
I'd be happy to. So as you mentioned, Next After is really three things. So we are a fundraising research lab, we're a consultancy, and we're a training institute. And I'll just briefly describe those three pillars and how they fit together to form what I think is our unique value proposition. So starting first with the research, we do two types of research here at Next After, both forensic research and applied research. When I refer to forensic research, basically what that means is we're going and analyzing large amounts of data across the nonprofit sector. And what we're looking for in the data is patterns that lead to opportunities to unlock greater digital fundraising performance. So we are hyper focused around digital. We believe, like many, it is the future of fundraising, but it's still an underdeveloped channel for many organizations in the space. The challenge that we've run into, quite frankly, with the kind of research that we like to do, is that what we're most interested in is trying to experience the charity, the nonprofit, the NGO from the donor's point of view. And so we found the best way to capture that perspective is simply by becoming donors ourselves. So that's what we do. Probably about 2 to 4 times a year, we'll launch a major mystery donor study. We'll go subscribe to hundreds of different organizations across the sector at the same time, subscribe to their content, monitor what they send to us, analyze it. And when they ask us to give a donation, we'll go online to their website. We'll go through the process of giving a gift as small as $20, as large as $5,000. And then we continue to monitor how these organizations communicate with us over time. And what we're trying to do basically is just understand the journey, the donor journey, from the lens of the communication that we receive from being a casual visitor to subscriber to donor and beyond. And it's fascinating work. What's always so interesting is how wildly varying that communication experience is from organization to organization. So when we do these studies, we inevitably see different people doing different things, different organizations doing different things. And so we start to kind of question that. We say, okay, well, what works best? I mean, if organization A is doing it one way, organization B is doing it a completely different way, how do we know what is going to generate the most responses? And so we take some of the insights that we glean from the mystery donor work. We use it to power the other kind of research we do, which is applied research. And that's where we're basically using the web as not just a channel of communication, but as a laboratory where we can run rigorous scientific experiments to understand what works and what doesn't. So to date, I think we've documented about 3,400 different online fundraising experiments across a whole range of different organizations. And we learned some things. One of the things that we learned is a lot of our long-held best practices about what works and what doesn't are wrong. So we take the research and all the testing stuff we do, we bring all the learnings into the two other parts of our company. The Institute is really the training and equipping arm of Next After. We develop resources, templates, guides, ebooks, we do webinars, we've got 9 different certification courses, really just instructing people based on things we've tested about what works and what doesn't. And then the last piece is our consultancy. So we function as a digital agency of record for about 42 larger nonprofit organizations.
Well, I want to see if what you're doing primarily with online fundraising applies to some of the things that Convergent does. And what I heard in what you're saying, the importance of communications, the content and how you do it. So when Convergent ends a campaign, we leave a campaign client with an instructional manual, basically, and we call it investor relations. Do you have some thoughts on what would be effective ways for an organization, and they typically have a website, to communicate in it with their investors in terms of encouraging that continued investment in that organization?
Well, I'll tell you, Jay, I'm going to give you the most valuable thing we've learned over the last 10 years of doing research like this. And that is that most nonprofit organizations fail to effectively communicate their value proposition. So the reason why this is so important is because out of all of our testing, all of our research, the number one thing that we find that moves the needle in a significant way is how impactfully we do communicate that value proposition. So the question is, okay, well, what's your value proposition? And when I ask that question, I get a lot of answers. And most of the time, it's not a value proposition. A value proposition is not your mission statement. It's not what you do. It is the answer to a fundamental question that every single one of your donors or investors in your case asks or needs to hear the answer to, but they're never usually going to verbalize it. And the question is this: if I am your ideal donor, your ideal investor, why should I give to you rather than some other organization or not at all? That's the fundamental question that we have to try to answer. And we can't answer it from a organizational centric point of view. We have to answer it through the lens of our donors. And so this takes some work because a value proposition is not something that we can declare. It's not a flag that we plant in the ground and say, here's our value proposition, bow down to it. It's something that we have to discover because it lives inside the hearts and the minds of our financial supporters. So that's why research and testing is really important. That's why surveys and asking your donors questions is really important. And quite frankly, that's why we do so much testing work, is to try to validate what our hypothesis about what we think our value proposition is and how that's going to move our people to give. So that's the first thing that I think everybody needs to kind of get a handle on.
Tim, what are the best ways to express your value proposition? Is it a you'll feel warm and fuzzy if you give to us, or there'll be this other type of return on your investment? What are your thoughts?
In my best expression of what a value proposition is it's an argument, right? It's a reason why somebody should give. So like, if I ask that question, why should I give to you rather than someone else or not at all? The response should start with because, right? Because we, you know, this and this and this and this and this. And so an exercise that I would encourage everybody that's listening to do is get your board together, your leadership team, or just a small group of folks that are close to your organization, and try to answer that question. Come up with as many claims of value, many reasons as to why somebody should give to you rather than someone else. And then there's a process you can go through to score those claims of value. So what we found is a value proposition has four key dimensions: appeal. It's got to be something that people like, that they want. Exclusivity, meaning you need to do something that's different or do it, go about it in a different way than some of your quote unquote competitors, right? It has to be something that's credible. People have to believe it and trust it and believe that you're the right person that can actually deliver upon that, which means that you probably need evidentials, which is like facts to kind of back up the reasons why you're the best. And then finally, it has to be communicated in a clear manner that makes sense using the donor's own vernacular. Sometimes we kind of use, you know, our own kind of, organizational centric speak, our insider baseball, and it doesn't translate to the donor. And so if they can't understand it, they can't appreciate it, they don't understand the appeal, and they're not going to be attracted to that. So that would be something I think that, you know, we can all do. And then finally, once you go through that exercise, just write out as long of a, I mean, it doesn't matter how long or how short, just write out that argument as to why somebody should give to you. And then go test it, right? That's the thing, is then go test it with your donors. Have conversation. Ask some of your folks that are close to you and support. Say, hey, do you think that this is true? Do you think that this is appealing? Do you think that this is one of the reasons why you would give? And you might be surprised by the responses.
Well, how do outcomes enter in with the value statement. So for instance, we could say, let's take a homeless shelter. We're providing meals and a rooftop for someone over a period of time, and we serve 4,000 individuals in a year. Is that a value proposition?
It is. What I would suggest is that that might be appealing. That might be something that's attractive to your donors, but I don't think it's exclusive, because I could probably think of hundreds of organizations that are doing that all over the country, right? So what makes you different? How are you approaching it differently? What is it that is, you know, your own kind of spin on how you can actually do that more efficiently, more effectively, more innovatively than anybody else in the space? Like, that's the differentiator that has to be communicated. Because if you think about like those two variables of appeal and exclusivity, if I have something that's very, very appealing and I have a lot of competing options, it dilutes the potency of the appeal. So I've got to find something that's appealing that I am doing, you know, either I'm the only one or I'm doing it very, very differently than everybody else.
I'm wondering if there's a point of view that marks you as different or appealing because the outcome isn't that you feed 4,000 and give them a roof over their head for a period of time, but providing that allows them the comfort and the ability to go look for work, which can be very difficult if you're hungry and you don't have you don't know where you're going to be staying the next night. And so an outcome might be, is that a differentiator that, you know, this is really what the value proposition is. We're allowing a man or a woman to become a productive member of society by some of these benefits that we're providing.
I think that's a great start right there, Jerry. That's a perfect way of repackaging what it is that you stated in the first articulation of that in a way that makes it sound like it's different, it's attractive, and it's actually doing something bigger than just providing food and shelter for people. That's what makes a really good value proposition.
And that's why we call that the investment-driven fundraising model, because that's what we're interested in providing to the organization, is for them to think about the outcomes that make a difference in a community or in an individual's life. I was listening to a podcast that you were on. The podcasters made the comment about donating or investing money in an organization is irrational behavior. Do you think that's really true?
100%. Yeah. I mean, you think about it. If like aliens landed from outer space and like we were trying to explain to them like this whole philanthropy thing, like, you know, so you go and you're going to give your valuable stuff to somebody else or some other organization, you're not going to get anything like, you know, valuable, necessarily tangibly valuable in return. They'd be like, does not compute. Like poor Mr. Spock, his head would explode and all that kind of stuff. So I think it is very irrational behavior, but you know what? We make irrational decisions all the time. And that's why I think that, you know, studying that question, why do people give, is such an interesting one, because I've learned things about myself and about how I make decisions and how I like assign value to different things in my life. That's really helped bring clarity to why I do the things I do, which is kind of like philosophy, really.
Rationally speaking, and research, I believe, has shown this, that individuals who give of themselves, whether it's their time or talent or treasure, that feeling is something that's expressed. And I would say, yeah, it's not tangible, but it's rational.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I would say that most people don't sit down and think about that as they approach this decision of whether or not I should give. It's more of a visceral kind of gut response. And so on the surface, it seems to be irrational, but you're absolutely right. If you study this, you find that it actually is not just rational, it's very pragmatic. I can't expect it or think that I would live in a world where being generous is a bad strategy for life and living, right? I can't live in a world like that.
Yeah, that's a great point. So you're an expert and your firm is an expert in virtual fundraising, internet, and so forth. Are there tips for virtual fundraising that you give to your clients that might translate, since Convergent and some other organizations still do face-to-face? And we're not talking about street fundraising, where you're walking down the street and you know, somebody with a clipboard comes and asks you to invest, learning something about the investor or donor before we speak to them, providing this value from the organization standpoint to deliver to the individual face-to-face.
What works in fundraising fundamentally that has worked from the very beginning still works now. And that is that people give to people. People do not give to websites. They don't give to emails. They don't give to direct mail or to telephone campaigns. People give to people. And so what we have found is that one of the reasons why digital communications or any sort of mass marketing is so ineffective is because it loses our humanity in the process of delivering a message, right? Let me give you a very practical example. Let's think about email fundraising for a second. Now, and if I pulled up an email fundraising appeal from pretty much any nonprofit organization, we'd see some common themes. First of all, it would probably be HTML design, meaning it's got some design template around it. It's got lots of images and graphics and big clickable buttons. And if you read the copy, especially if it's from a very large, you know, national or international organization, the copy would sound like it's written from a professional marketer or communicator or copywriter, because it usually in fact is. And the problem is when a potential donor sees that in their inbox, all they see is somebody trying to market to them. And people don't want to be marketed to. I don't want to be marketed to. No, you don't want to be marketed to. People want to be communicated with. And so something that we've tested in our lab with dozens of organizations, we've done it in different countries, we've done it in different languages. And what we find is that when you get rid of all that marketing veneer, get rid of the images, get rid of the templates, get rid of the buttons, and even rewrite your copy so it sounds like it's coming from one human to another human, 200, 300, 400, 500% increase in response rate results when we take that approach. So you have to ask the question, well, why? And it's because people give to people. And the more we humanize our communications and make them seem like it is a one-to-one conversation between two people sitting over a cup of coffee, the more effective it is.
What about the length of the copy? What's your research shown about that?
Honestly, in many cases, it's unintuitive. People think, oh, I got to be short and pithy and, you know, just to the point. And we've tested 2,200 word emails versus 100 word emails. And what we find is that the 2,200 word emails in many cases actually outperforms the shorter pithy ones. And it doesn't really come down to, like, you know, long versus short. It really comes down to how much real estate do you need in order to effectively communicate your value proposition in a way that it resonates with your ideal donor. In some organizations, they have donors that are readers. They love to read. We know this because, just like you said, when you're sitting down and you're having a conversation with somebody, you're getting to know them. I'm getting to know them based off of their web behavior, how they interact with my website. And if I see that I have an organization whose constituents read article after article after article after article, I'm like, okay, these people are readers. They actually are able to absorb value through the written word. So those people, let's go test more copy. Let's give them more of what they really love, which is text to read. It comes down to what is the right mix to be able to create a communication that's going to most resonate with your donor.
We think that the three tangible things that we reference in terms of what motivates a donor is their care or concern about the organization that they're investing in. You talked about people to people. That's the connection. And then, of course, what is the individual's or the corporate capacity?
I think we're just using different words to say the same thing. And I think that, again, that goes to the fact that there are certain immutable laws of fundraising.
You're in the nonprofit industry. You're obviously a talented individual. You have a lot of skill sets. What led you to the nonprofit side of work?
I took a very indirect pathway into the nonprofit space. So I started a business out of college. It was a digital marketing company. I did that for about 5 years. About 5 years into it, my church was building a new building and we were doing a capital campaign. They hired these consultants and they said, you know, there's all these different communication things that we need to go put together. I said, well, that's what my company does. We can do that. So I volunteered to participate in the capital campaign and do all the marketing materials for it. And I kind of fell in love with, you know, fundraising. I was like, I'm doing what I feel like I've been wired to do, which is marketing, but I'm doing it for a cause I care about. I ended up, it happened actually pretty quick. I sold my business and we sold our house and I moved to Fort Lauderdale, Florida to go work for a nonprofit. I got there. The day I got there, the founder of the organization who had been there for 35 years had a heart attack. So that organization was like a $36 million a year organization annual budget. And then we like shrunk to like, I don't know, 16 million in 12 months. So it was like a death spiral. And I was hired to do digital communications. They said, look, whatever you're doing on the internet, figure out how that stuff raises money. And so that was my first violent shove into fundraising. And I didn't like it at first. I thought it was a necessary evil. And I met a guy who ran a direct response marketing company based out of Dallas. And they were our agency. They did all of our direct mail communications. And he said, look, we've been doing direct mail for 35 years. We'd love to get in this digital space. Would you consider coming to Dallas and helping us start a digital fundraising division? I said, well, I don't know fundraising. He said, we don't know digital. We can help each other. And that's kind of how I got into the current career path. I was there for a few years. We got acquired by another agency. And then I left to start Next After in 2012.
What do you think are some of the biggest challenges that nonprofit leaders face today? I mean,
the first thing is like, you know, not understanding what your value proposition is. So that's the first, very important one, at least as it relates to the kind of work that we do in fundraising, that's essential. I think that there's a scarcity mindset, that there's actually unlimited resources out there. The limitation is that we're not conveying a big enough vision that's going to captivate the imagination of the people that have the capacity to stroke those transformational checks. So I think that goes back to leadership and vision and even, relates to value proposition. I think that we have, a lot of artificial constraints that are put on us in the nonprofit space, like certain percentages of how much we can spend on this or that or whatever. So we're kind of like measuring efficiency as opposed to impact. And I use the example, I've got two organizations. They both did the exact same thing. They're trying to solve the exact same problem. One's a $100 million organization with 50% efficiency, which means 50 cents out of the dollar actually goes to making a difference. The rest is, overhead, I guess is what they would call that. And then there's a $1 million organization has 99% efficiency. Which one is doing more good? Give them that example. It's very, very easy. So I think that that's a challenge, obviously attracting talent and retaining talent. Usually what happens is, nonprofits have these really talented individuals and they get to a certain point because they can't pay them more because then they're going to break their, overhead threshold. And so then a lot of their talented people come and work for companies like ours, right? You know what I mean? Like they'll go flip over and become a consultant and say, look, I've got, a greater income earning potential being a consultant than staying with my organization.
So thanks for joining us. We really appreciate your insight.
Thank you, Jay.
To find out more about Convergent and our services and a list of our podcasts, please visit convergentnonprofit.com. Click on the resources link at the top of the homepage. Thanks for listening.